See, I told y'all, it's going to be a good one. You thought I was kidding you. We're going to go for it. And so let's start off the end of the Bible. Let's go to Revelation 21. Now, the Bible is a lot of things, and there's different ways to think of it and understand it. And one of the things that helps me, I think, because God built us this way, is to think of it as a story. And stories have a definite pathway, and the Bible has, like every good story, a concrete beginning and a concrete end, and a bunch of stuff in the middle. And so one way to approach Advent, because Advent means arrival, and there are two arrivals of Jesus in the story. And so when you start at the beginning, it kind of launches this story arc, and then Jesus shows up in person, and that's the first Advent. And then the arc keeps going. Jesus goes to heaven, and then he's coming back. That's the second arrival, and that's kind of toward the end of the book. So that's if it's an arrow that gets shot, the second arrival is kind of toward the end of the arrow landing. And so one way you can approach the Advent season as a Bible teacher is to start at the beginning, and the closer you get to Christmas, the closer you get to that first arrival, you kind of work your way chronologically till you get there, and that's great. What I want to do is I want to start on the other end. I want to start at the end of the story and work our way backwards. And so we're going to start with the landing point of the arrow, and then next Sunday move a little bit back and then a little bit back, and to where at Christmas time we land that way. So we're going to tell a story from the end to the beginning rather than the beginning to the end. And so if you're sitting there and you're thinking the end of the story, that means we get to talk about Armageddon and the Antichrist and all that kind of stuff. Come back next week, because there'll be some of that as part of next week. But today I want to talk about what's on the other side of all that. Like when the arrow lands, what is happening there? And so we're going to start at the end of the book. And in a sense, we're talking about heaven. And I know that there's been a lot of talk of heaven over the last several months around here, because we've been looking at on earth as it is in heaven and those kinds of things, and kind of what's the Jewish understanding of heaven and those kinds of things. But I want to think less of like heaven as God's space where his will is carried out, like less of that, and more heaven in the sense of like what most people think about when you bring up the word heaven. You know, it's sort of that, like, we've pulled from like literature and art a lot of like, oh, it's angels and the streets are gold and there's clouds and harps and those kinds of things. It kind of has like a lot of that kind of tone to it. Everything is easy. Everything is perfect. Everything is like the way you always wanted it to be. That's heaven. Some people would boil it down and say it's where you go when you die. You know, that's kind of also what I'm talking about a little bit, like what happens there. We think of heaven typically as being very far away and like up there. And it's like the place we fly away to, right? The old hymns, all right? Those kinds of things. And within all that, there's like kind of this sense of like, man, we get to escape this place and go somewhere else. That's kind of how, like, in our world, in our culture, we sort of, when you bring up heaven, if you brought it up to a coworker, if even if they didn't have any basis of knowing Jesus, they would probably like, what do you think about in heaven? And they're going to rattle off, you know, those kinds of things. The real question is, what does the Bible say about heaven? That's really what we have to do. And like I said, not heaven in the sense of like God's space where his will is carried out. More of like, what is the landing point of the story? What does that sound like? And so the Bible has a lot to say about it, but Revelation 21 and 22 is going to be home base for us today at least. And let me say a few things about the book of Revelation. First of all, as I studied, almost everyone that I read was like, one of their first points were like, it's Revelation singular, not Revelations plural. And so I just felt obligated to pass that on to you, because apparently it drives theologians crazy. It's one revelation. It was given to John, the same John. There's debates about everything, of course, with the Bible. But most people think it's the same John that wrote the Gospel of John and 1st, 2nd, 3rd John. John, who like walked with Jesus, was part of Jesus's inner circle, that same John. He wrote it when he was like in his mid-80s probably, which was 20, 25 years longer than most people lived at that time. And so John had seen a lot. To be one of the first disciples that's called to be with Jesus through his whole ministry, to watch the death, burial, resurrection of Jesus, like to be an eyewitness of that, a partaker of that, to be there when Jesus ascended and said, "Wait in Jerusalem till I send the gift of the Spirit to you," and to be there at Pentecost that day when the church was born, and to then give leadership to this brand new like thing that Jesus was so excited to finally get going, and to live 60 more years, you know? He'd seen a lot of things. And he is a political prisoner when he writes this. So Christianity was an outlawed religion. And so they had to practice it in secret and those kinds of things. And it was not a good situation. We think of Nero, the emperor, who like really led the charge in making Christianity like a bad deal. Lots of persecution, lots of death, and lots of torture, and just trying to rid Rome of this religion. And then a bunch of other emperors come along, and you have Domitian is the emperor when Revelation is written, and Domitian was just as bad as Nero. He's just not quite as famous. And so if they caught you practicing the religion, sometimes they would kill you, sometimes they would torture you. They had these prison camps that they would send you to. And so John, as a guy in his mid-80s, was sent to a prison camp on an island. And he's out there, and he had been in Ephesus for like 30 years. And he's on the island, and he gets this revelation. And the word revelation, it means apocalypse. First of all, but we think of apocalypse as like Mad Max and like those kinds of things. Apocalypse to us culturally kind of loses where their original comes from. Apocalypse, it means literally to take the lid off of something. It means to reveal, to uncover. This is God like pulling back the curtain and letting John see some realities, so that he could then write them down and send them to the seven churches in the region where he was pastoring, because those people are living a hard life. Like the cost has been very high for them to follow Jesus, and it looks like Rome is winning. It looks like the empire is taking over. And they've been waiting on Jesus for like 60 years now, and he hadn't shown up. And it was getting really, really easy to give up on what Jesus is doing and to just live like Rome wants you to live, because it's just easier sometimes. And so what God does is he takes John, this faithful disciple, and says, "Okay, I'm going to show you something, and you're going to be the steward of this revealing, this apocalypse, this opening the lid, this pulling back the curtain. You're going to write it down. You're going to send it to the churches, because they need to know what's really going on, and they need to be encouraged to be steadfast and to endure, because everything that you see is not really what's happening, and God is doing something." And so some of it is, what is God doing in their moment? Some of it is going to be like looking at the end of the story. And I was thinking about this, I was trying to think of like, how have I experienced this before? When I was a younger man, a new horror movie came out. I'm not from the Halloween generation, I'm from the Scream generation, right? All my Gen Xers are like, yes. And so I remember going to the movies with friends to watch Scream, and it scared the mess out of us. Like, we were just like, what is happening? It was crazy. The person on all the posters and the trailers was like gone in the first 10 minutes. And you're like, I don't even know what to make of this anymore. It was just so unique and new to us, and it was amazing. Year later, Halloween time comes around, and it came out on VHS. And so we go to Blockbuster and rent it, and a bunch of us pile up in an apartment and watch it. And you, like, it was still like you jumped and you were nervous and tense and all that, but we knew what was going to happen because we had seen it. Like, we knew what was going to happen to Drew Barrymore. We knew who the bad guys were. We knew how that was all going to work. And so you still jumped and you still were tense, but you weren't as tense because you knew the ending. And then over the years, you just watch it again and again, and then it just gets to where you just laugh the whole way through it, right? Because you know the end. I think that's a little bit of what God is doing here. It's saying like, hey, you're in the midst of something that is so, this is freaking you out, and it's slowing the gospel, and it's wrecking your faith. Let me show you the end of the story so that as you go through it, you're not quite as scared and you're not jumping quite as much. And maybe even to the point where you can agree with what Paul says when he says, these are light and momentary afflictions. You know? So that's a little quick primer on Revelation. It's not a secret code about the end of the world. Hate to break it to all of us, anyone who's hanging on to it and trying to interpret the war in Israel and Palestine based on what's happening here, that's not the point. That's not what's going on. It does tell us things about the future, but it's not a cheat code. We're sitting here figuring out like, oh, I know what's going to happen next. You know, like a lot of people made a lot of money off of that and have a lot of followers, and a lot of fear has come from that stuff. But that's not the point of Revelation. It is written in code because if you think about it, here's this illegal religion. Let's say Rome busts into your worship service, like, what's going on here? And they take this letter and they're like, oh, if it's clearly stating everything, that's very condemning. But if it's like a dragon and a babble, and like, what is all this going on? Bowls and horns and lights and elders and whatever. Here's your silly, like, mythic whatever. They don't know what it means, but the house churches were sitting there and being like, oh, we get this. Because it's filled with references to the Old Testament and the prophets and all these little things to us that we're reading it. We're like, this is weird. And they would have been like, no, that comes from Ezekiel. No, that comes from Zephaniah. Like, it would have resonated with them. And so it was written so that Rome wouldn't know what was going on, to bless them, to say, this is how the movie ends. Hang in there. Okay, that's really the end of it. All right, look at Revelation 21. So all of that is happening. In 19 and 20, you should just go read it. It's amazing. So it gets to 21. I just want to read the whole thing, but we'll be here forever. So I'm just going to go a verse at a time. Look at just the first verse. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. Okay, so all this stuff has gone on, like all this stuff about the Lamb and what Kent read earlier, like there's this realization of what Jesus has done, that evil has been put away with forever. We're on the other side of the second coming and all the crazy stuff, and the arrow has landed, and it's like, look around. And the first thing he sees is a new heaven and a new earth. Now, John, in John chapter 1, he begins his gospel talking about creation, which comes from Genesis chapter 1. So this immediately is a throwback to the Old Testament. He's saying it's just like in Genesis, like God is creating this new thing. It's like earth and heaven, but it's new. It's like the same, but somehow it's different. There's no other way to describe it. And so when we talk about heaven, what we really probably should talk about is the new earth. He's making a new earth. It's like this earth, but it's somehow different. So he's connecting it to Genesis 1. But that word new, it's the word Greek word kainos. And it doesn't mean like newly created, like he did in Genesis 1. It means like recreated. So in Genesis 1, there's a lot of like God like shaping this earth and all this kind of thing. But it isn't that he like, hey, he creates a new world out of thin air. He's not creating another planet for us to fly away to. He's somehow making this place new. It means to be renewed. It's new not meaning other, new meaning this one, just different. And you think about it, here's this guy, he's trying to just describe it. He's like, I don't know how to describe it. It's like I'm looking at this new place, but it's the same place, but it's new. It's recreated, so it's like this, but it's, so, you know, I feel like there's like a loop that he can get caught in there. It says, the sea is no more. The sea was a place of chaos and disorder for them. Two things, nighttime, the sea. Those were places of danger. And he's like, yeah, and there's like nothing scary in this new creation. So God's doing this new thing. The old thing has like somehow passed away. It's just completely different. So it's almost like, in a sense, it's like he's taking us back to the beginning of the story. He's taking us back to Eden, but it's a new Eden. And he keeps going. Verse 2, I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. Okay, so Jerusalem is where God lives. He's like, so it's new heaven, new earth, and there's like a new city, like a new city of God. It's like our Jerusalem, but it's recreated somehow. It's like new and better. And it's coming down. Notice that. It's coming down. He's not going to it. Like, it's like God's like handing it to us. It's coming here. Like a bride adorned for her husband. It's another way of saying it's beautiful. Like, there's this wedding imagery that's all throughout, you know, this whole story. And it's like this beautiful new Jerusalem that's coming down to us. It's not, John's like, and then I flew away to it. And he's like, no, God's coming to us. God's coming here. What's really important for us to have in our minds is, it isn't that God's like, I'm going to get you out of here and start over in this other part of the universe somewhere. He's like, no, I'm just going to make all this new. I'm going to bring it to you. It's going to be adorned like a bride on her wedding day. And I'm going to do the work. I'm going to bring it to you. That's what we're talking about here. Verse 3. I heard a loud voice from the throne said, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. That's heaven. That's what makes it heaven. You know? There's a lot of other things that we'll talk about, a lot of other descriptions and things like that that make it awesome. But like, you want to know what God is doing? It is about God dwelling with us. That's what he's doing. That is how it was in Eden, before sin entered into the world and there was separation between us and God. That's how it is when God would manifest among them in the tabernacle and in the temple, until Jesus came along and he was like, okay, this is what we're doing. I'm dwelling among you. Like, I'm setting up a tent and like living among you. But Jesus is coming back in the second advent to be like, okay, are you ready? Because I'm about to make all this new, and then we're just going to dwell together. Remember that verse in Genesis where it says God was walking in the garden in the cool of the day? I love that verse. You like walk through a garden, you're like, whoa, hey, dude. That we live in this world where God seems far away sometimes. He seems distant. He seems all of these things. And we kind of just get blurry vision sometimes about it. And I was like, hey, let me pull back the curtain. Let me reveal. Don't forget the end of the story. Okay. That's where we're going. The dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them. They will be his people. God himself will be with them as their God. He told Israel that all through the Exodus. Like, that's just been a part of the narrative of like, you will be my people. I will be your God. You will be my people. I will be your God. That's what's happening. It's just easy to forget it sometimes. So then look at verse 4. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore. For the former things have passed away. Now again, we read that and we're thinking on the absolute right track. That he will be close enough and care enough to wipe your tears away. You might be thinking, what do we have to cry about? We're going to cry in heaven? I mean, Eric Clapton wrote a song about it, right? Like, isn't that not a thing? And, I mean, I've told Eric so many times, like, dude, that's not really biblical, but I don't know. Now, it doesn't say that there won't be tears. It just says that there won't be crying or mourning or, like, weeping and those kind of things because of the death and pain that we have known here. But maybe we'll be so emotionally in tune in heaven that we're like, I just can't stop crying that Jesus is like right there. I got to check the scars myself, you know. I just cannot believe that this is our reality. Maybe it's like those kinds of tears. They'll be close enough and he'll care enough. But also in here, there are quotes from like Isaiah and Jeremiah, and throughout this whole passage, Ezekiel, Zechariah, there's like all these prophetic things. And here's what I think is so cool about this, and I came across this a couple of times, is people saying, you know, everything that those prophets were pointing to and hoping for, and many of them never saw a bit of fruit from it, it's all coming. None of it is lost. In that first century, in those churches, and they're reading this letter, and they're like, oh, that's from this prophet, that's from this prophet. They were right. They were right. God's with us, and he's going to meet us in all of these things, but notice what is not with us is pain, this like constant companion of ours. And so God's like, okay, I'm going to be with you. Wipe away your tears, all that stuff. Pain will not be a part of any of this. And this new creation thing that I'm doing, that somehow you as a person will be a part of this new creation order, where you will be you, but you'll be the like uncorrupted, pure, perfect version of you. And we'll get hung up sometimes and like, you know, like, oh, are we all gonna like look a certain way and how old will we be and like those kinds of things. That's all very, very like shallow, honestly. Think about like you will be the you that God intended you to be with sin never having affected you. It's like that version of you. You think about all the things about you and me and like all of us that we're just like, God, this about me and this, and I can't get over this, I can't get past this and struggle with this. Or you see like progress in certain areas, like, yes, this is awesome, but why can't I do it over here? And, you know, we're kind of just caught in that thing all the time. And yet when the arrow lands and he's like, I'm making it all new, we're a part of that, you know? So you'd be like, oh, this is who you always saw me to be. This is why you like corrected me and challenged me and convicted me when I wasn't living out this version of me. Oh, this is why you encouraged me and spurred me on. This is why you put me in that church, or in that community group, or in that friendship, in that marriage, in that family. And you put me in all these kinds of things because you saw this version of me the whole time. And no one else saw it. I didn't see it, but you saw it. And now I get it. And I just am so thankful that I just can't stop the tears. And he's like, come see. You know? Our relationships will be renewed. No tension, no baggage, no like tiptoeing around, no having to be like, well, I kind of want to say this, but I'm not sure how to do it. And all the weirdness between us. Creation will be renewed, like flourishing finally. I mean, the ground will not work against us. We won't have like drought where we're like, I heard someone saying the other day, like, we don't even know if Christmas trees are gonna be available because of how little rain has happened and this. And I'm like, oh man, like that's, there's just all these weird things that happen. And it's like, no, creation's gonna like cooperate. We'll still work it and keep it and tend it and all that kind of stuff, but it's gonna like be awesome. Our awareness of God will be renewed. We'll never be self-absorbed or distracted or just busy, you know. We'll never show up. You know, sometimes you show up for church and you're like, man, I haven't even thought about the Lord since last time we were together. This week's been crazy. No more of that. No more seemingly like God's far away or God's distant or God's mad at me or like any of those kind of like things. It's just this like completely renewed awareness. Former things have passed away. All that has passed away, and there's this new earth, this new heaven, and this new us. Look at verse 5. He who was seated on the throne said, now, all that other stuff, that was spoken not directly. That was spoken from like a voice. We don't know who said it. This is from the throne. Behold, I am making all things new. And then he tells John, write it down. These words are trustworthy, and these words are true. And so a part of our Advent journey, a part of us recognizing the arrivals of Jesus is us looking backwards at the first arrival, forward to the second arrival, but also what's on the other side of that? What is the landing point when God like pulls back the end and says, this is what the end of the story looks like? And I don't know how John was able to write it down. Like, how did he explain it all? Can you imagine? I just wonder if he was sitting there in this moment and from the throne, God says, I am making all things new. If there was like a big pause between that part and if John was just like just so stunned and weeping and whatever, and he's like, hey, dude, write it down. Write it down. My people need to know this. There's 7 churches in that region that need to know this because they want to quit and they want to give up. They're convinced that Rome is winning. They're convinced that their pain has the final word. They're convinced that all of this is just to be thrown out the window. They need to know it. And they trust you. And I trust you. So, bro, write it down. Even if you can't describe it, do your best. Write it down. Send it to them. And if we were to keep going 6 through 21, there's so much there, but just a quick summary. Talks about how the gospel is leading people to life, and there is an evil out there that's leading people to death. That's what's at stake. Like, that's what's happening. There is this like Roman power, this like rat race. There's all this stuff going on, and we can share that very, very easily. That life is so full of this and this and this and this and this, and it's so distracting. It's so whatever, and we have all these questions. And he's like, "Look, I'm leading people to life, but there is evil out there. It's leading people to death. And you guys have the message. You have the gospel. You have the proclamation of the good news that Jesus is alive. And so don't forget that's a part of why you're there." Is to be a faithful witness in the midst of all that stuff. Then he starts to describe the city, and he describes this massive city that's 1,400 square miles. And I'm irresponsible, so I had a graphic I was going to show, but just picture the United States and draw a line from like the bottom of Florida over to like the bottom of Texas and New Mexico, all the way up into the Dakotas, and then all the way over to like Buffalo. Like that's 1,400 square miles. And Old Testament folks, if you ever read their stuff, they love to measure things. They love to put a lot of details, that kind of stuff. So he describes how massive the city is, which is basically a way of saying, Jerusalem, as they understood it, was like this, and That's where God lived, and it was just very, very small. And he's like, hey, this place has got enough room for everyone. Like, there's plenty to go around. But then, look at verse 22. I saw no temple in the city. So you would think, if you go back to the Old Testament, there are all these descriptions of Jerusalem and this and this and this and the temple and how big it should be and how to adorn it and how to do all these kinds of things. But John's like, so there's the city, so the temple should be right there in the middle of it, and it should be massive if it's a 1,400 square mile city. But there's no temple. Why is there no temple? And he says, well, 22, there's no temple, for its temple is the Lord. Like, there's no need to have a building where God is hanging out and living. There's no need for the temple. There's no need for a sacrificial system. There's no need for all the things that they were so used to associating with the not only the presence of God, but the pleasure of God. It's like, hey, we don't need that anymore because I'm just with you. And that would have probably made no sense to them. I was like, yeah, there's really not a temple. And let's just keep reading for fun. Look at 23. The city had no need of sun or moon to shine on it. For the glory of God gives it light, and its lamp is the Lamb. That's not saying that like there won't be like a sun and like, all those kind of things, but like it's just like for them, darkness and night was fear-inducing. And I said, like, hey, Jesus is so bright. He's so present. Like, we don't even need all of these things. Look at verse 24. By its light will the nations walk. And the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. What does that mean? What are the kings of the earth doing right now? They're fighting each other. They're trying to get power. They're trying to get money. They're trying to get land. They're trying to get their militaries together. They're trying to like dominate. They're trying to like. That's how it is. And yes, there's a degree of trying to do that for their citizens. But like, there's just all of this mess that's out there, and it's like, you know what happens when the arrow lands is all the kings are like, hey, let's bring all our glory into this guy's palace, you know, let's bring it all to his feet, because you know who's not fighting anymore on the new earth? Israel and Palestine. I don't know what that means. Don't go getting all like crazy on me. Don't put that on the internet of like, oh, look at this clip of this crazy guy. I don't need any of that kind of stuff. I'm just saying when the arrow lands, whoever's in charge of this country and this country and this country and this country, they're all going to like come together in worship of the Lamb somehow. Does that mean that what is happening now is irrelevant? No, it just means it's not ultimate. Sometimes it feels ultimate, though, right? We feel so helpless. And God's saying, hey, at some point, all this is going to be dealt with. That there is a justice that is coming. There is a realization that is coming where they're all going to recognize, like, oh, he's the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. So let's bring all of our glory into his presence and his feet. Luke 25, its gates will never be shut by day. Talking about the city. Gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. They'll bring into it the glory and the honor of the nations, but nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's book of life. There's nothing to fear. For them, nighttime, the sea, like those things are gone. But they also were afraid of the nations. They were afraid of other kings. They were afraid of Rome. They were afraid of Domitian. They were afraid of all these things. And he's like, hey, none of that stuff that's terrifying you is going to be there anymore. And you know how you're having to always guard the gates of your city against invasion and all this kind of stuff? The gates are there, but they're just open. If you even pull that into our study here, you won't have to guard the gates of your eyes, your ears. You won't have to tell your kids to turn the TV off because there's some weird commercial that just came on, you know? You don't have to, like, guard every single thing that's going on. We don't have to be so vigilant. He's like, because nothing evil is coming in. Everything you see, everything you hear, everything that you are about, everything is purified. You just get to live your life. And if for right now, what we have to do is hang in there and do those things to honor the Lord and honor each other, we have to do it knowing that the end of the story has been written already. And so we're like me and my friends sitting in an apartment watching Scream. We're like, I'm not quite as scared because I know how the end is. Now look at 22. I know I don't have a lot of time, but this is too good. I'm going to cruise from here on, I promise. Look at Revelation 22, verse 1. Then, like that's not enough. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city. And also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. Okay, stop right there. So I thought it was a city, but this sounds like a garden. Somehow it seems to kind of be both. Like apparently you can have cities that also have gardens in them. I don't know. And where have we seen a garden before? Well, we've seen a garden in Eden. The God's original plan was not a city, it was a garden, but it was also like two people. And now you got multitudes. So it's this kind of combination of a city and a garden that's happening. And he's like, yeah, and the tree of life is there. When was the last time we saw the tree of life? Well, that was also in Eden. And so God is trying to help John and his readers, which would include us today, like think like, oh yeah, this is a return to Eden, but it's a new Eden. It's a room enough for everyone Eden. But that's this incredible thing that is happening. And so there's the tree of life. What waters the tree? Well, it's coming from the throne somehow. And so God is somehow watering this tree. It's on both sides of this river. And it's producing fruit, 12 different kinds of fruit. And 12 is a big Bible number. And that's all about people. 12 disciples, 12 tribes, like those kinds of things. And so like the people are going to be able to eat of this tree. It's going to produce year-round, which tells us that there's like time progressing. But it has this really interesting thing. This is the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. Like this is a place where that coming together somehow will happen. That everything that we as humans have been through and the things that we like shake our fist at God and like, where were you? How did you let this happen? He's like, hey, none of that's going to get lost. When you read the book of Revelation, when he pulls the curtain back, there is a justice that is coming. And so that thing that happened to you, that thing that happened to us, that thing that is happening around the world right now, whatever it may be, God's not like, oh, we're just going to, don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. It's all going to be fine. It's all going to be fine. He's like, no, it's, we're going to bring all that together and I'm going to heal it. I'm going to heal it with love and compassion, with justice, but I'm going to like literally like take all the fractures and I'm going to make those things whole again. And it's going to happen somehow at this tree. I don't know what that means or what that looks like, but I like the sound of that. There's prophecies where it talks about how there are times when you'll have to take your shovels and you'll have to make them into weapons. And then God comes in and changes everything, so you're like, man, we don't need these weapons anymore. Let's make them back into shovels. But yeah, exactly. Like that is coming. Everything that the prophets hung in there for, everything that the faithful have hung in there for, it's all coming. Look at verse 3. No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it. His servants will worship him. They will see his face. His name will be on their foreheads. Night will be no more. There'll be no need of, they will need no light or of lamp or sun, for the Lord their God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. Like, God's like, hey, I've made everything new. I've got everything in place. Let's reign together forever. Let's rule creation. forever. I just don't know what to do with that. Verse 6, he said to me, these words are trustworthy and true, and the Lord, the God of the Spirit of the prophets, has sent his angel to show his servants what must soon take place. And if you were to keep reading, Jesus says a couple of things really quickly. He says, I'm coming soon, I'm coming soon. I've sent my angel to testify. The last thing he says, I'm coming soon. Now, we think of soon in one sense. They obviously thought of soon in a different sense. And Jesus has his own definition of soon. Let's face it. But we tend to focus on the soon part instead of the I'm coming part. He wrote them all so that they would be encouraged to hang in there and don't fall for the myth that Rome is winning or that anything is winning. Pull back the curtain. That's the end of the story. Let that breathe hope into what you are doing right now. This is hope. So if that's how the Bible talks about heaven, it's very different than angels and clouds and everything's fine. It's very different than I go away somewhere else. It's very different than all those things. It's God making all things new here. That includes us. It means, will you let this encourage you and meet you where you are in your life? I think that's a part of what Advent is, just the brilliance of the early church fathers like coming up with this. Is like, we need to be reminded of this. Because sometimes life is a lot. Let me close with this really quickly. I know this is long. I kind of don't care, but I understand. I'm trying to be respectful. In Romans 8, Paul says this. It says, for the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. I think for us to think about the new earth and like what happens when we die and all that kind of stuff, I think that phrase, eager longing, I think there's something to that for us. That we should read this and there should be a part of us that aches for it. You know? We shouldn't fear it. We shouldn't be nervous about it. We should be like, man, I hope it's today, honestly. Jesus says, I'm coming soon. We're like, yes. That was the prayer of the early church, Maranatha. Come, Lord Jesus. That's the response at the end of the book. Jesus says, I'm coming soon. They're like, yes, amen. Come, Lord Jesus. Like, that's it. So eager longing, I think Paul's trying to communicate it. Of like, hey, we're waiting with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. Verse 20 says this, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. So there's eager longing, and I think there is in hope. They're like, yeah, I can hang in there because of that. I can endure because of that. I can be faithful. I can be steadfast. I can long suffer. I can walk through things. It's like Monica shared today. Like I can do it. I'm not alone. The end's been written. Hope is alive. Jesus is alive. When we bury our heads in life and we're just kind of drudging through, it's easy to miss it. And the scriptures are there to, hey, pick your head up. Look at the end of the story. Let that breathe hope into where you are. Okay. So that's where we're starting for Advent, is that idea. As you read through the devotional this week and you're thinking like that kind of hope, letting that breathe encouragement into where we are. Let's stand together. Let me pray for us. Lord God, we stand here as people who fit into what Paul said there in Romans 8. We're part of creation that's waiting with eager longing. We're part of creation that's waiting in hope, waiting to be set free from bondage to corruption and to obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. And we know, God, that you have given us a taste of that Heaven has come to us now. It's not just a future thing, it's a now thing. But at the same time, God, we do kind of ache for it, though, because things here are so hard sometimes. And Jesus, I'm so grateful that that isn't lost on you. I mean, you walked this earth, you interacted with sinners, you know exactly what we are capable of, and you walk with us in every moment. And even the letters that the churches that you wrote to in Revelation, you keep telling them, I walk among you, like I'm with you. And that's part of what is amazing about this kind of thinking in terms of the new earth, is that you're not waiting for us down at the end of the story. You're meeting us now in the moment. And so we thank you for your kindness and ask that you would help us to let this do what you intended for it to do, which is to bring hope to your sons and your daughters. We love you and pray this in your name. Amen. Next few minutes, we will have our time of response like we normally do. We will sing, and we're singing songs that are like themed in this way. There's the communion table. It's open over to your right. If you feel like stepping to the table and having someone offer you the body and blood broken, poured out for you, if that helps you connect to the hope to know, Jesus gave us this meal and said, you guys keep taking this meal, but Jesus is fasting from it until we have it together. And he's like, no, you need to do it, and you need to miss me while you're doing it. And as you miss me, to know I'm still meeting you where you are. And so that for you is helpful. Jesus' table is over here. You can come and pray. But God brought you here for a reason today. I think the songs, the scriptures all are part of it. So let's spend the next few minutes responding to him, and before we dismiss together. So our table is open whenever you're ready.